Tonight on Hemispheres, the Middle East Dialogues continues with Ibrahim Kazrouni and Rob Prince. This evening, Kazrouni and Prince will discuss the reasons behind the decline of U.S. power to dictate and influence conflicts in the Middle East. What are the reasons? What countries are challenging U.S. dominance in the Middle East? Will this change be good for the region? All that and more on Hemispheres, the Middle East Dialogues, tonight at 6.
I'm going to start.
Okay. Go ahead, Rob.
All right. So, for starters, let's say what we're really trying to do over these next two programs, to use a well-worn expression, is to see the forest through the trees when it comes to the Middle East. And in order to do that, however, one has to really do two things. First of all, one has to focus on the region, which we've tried to do. But the region is not isolated, and the region is influenced greatly by what's going on in the rest of the world. Not only is it influenced in terms of who's running the show, what's the major hegemonic imperialist power in the world at a certain moment in time, that's certainly one part of it. But the other part of it is also history. And so we want to take a look. We want to take a look at these processes in some detail, and that's why we've decided to do it over two programs. Among the things we're going to talk about, we want to talk about the rise and fall of empires, both contemporary and in the past. We want to look at the special situation of the United States, which considers itself, if you like, an exception to being an empire, but our argument is it is an empire, and we'll elaborate on that. We want to look at the trajectory, if you like, of U.S. hegemony in the 20th century, its rise and its partial decline. I did want to, there's a poem that comes to mind. I'm not going to read the whole thing. I believe many of your listeners are familiar with it. It's Shelley's Ozymandias. And I just want to read the last few lines of that poem. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look at my works, ye mighty, and despair, because I'm so strong and powerful. Nothing besides remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. I.e., one moment, Ozymandias is the king of a great kingdom, and in the end, it's gone, and all that's left is the sand. So what's going to be the fate of the modern empires and modern hegemony? Ibrahim, let's start by looking at empires in recent history. What can you tell us?
Well, thank you, Rob, for the intro. As you said, this is a topic that both is being addressed in the academic field, but also when we try to analyze and dissect the crisis that we are dealing with in the Middle East, and particularly American foreign policy and the failure of the American foreign policy. To be honest, although we are looking at it purely from, say, contemporary and the 20th century, but Ibn Khaldun, one of the great Muslim anthropologists, even in his book Al-Muqaddama, discusses the four stages of the rise and fall of the great power, which in our context it become hegemonic power, or we call it empire. The 20th century was certainly one of the transformation and transition. All the European powers were eclipsed by the U.S. And the Soviet Union. Today, U.S. is being challenged by the rise of China, Russia, India, Brazil, which is loosely defined as the BRICS country. And by these challenges, the political order is once again reshaped, which means the political order has been in a state of flux. Now we end of one phase and beginning of the other phase. We certainly have noticed American hegemonic power is coming under mounting strain, politically, economically, and militarily. The people really developed, the ideologue developed some kind of mythology or thesis that they call it the hegemonic stability theory in the international relation. For the world to be stable, you need one particular, which, we, by the way, we discussed this as we go on through this program. We need one strong, for the system to be stable, we need one strong and dominant power to dictate to the rest of the world. And if they were, that power were to be demolished, the whole stability of the constructed system is going to fall apart. And the propagators and advocate of this, they say by default, such a system need a force to be maintained, and it will be, otherwise it will be unstable and at any cost. So until the cost becomes prohibitive, where cracks appear, the problem that we have with this hegemonic stability theory, the person that takes the helm and becomes the number one power should be working for the public good and take the disproportionate share of the public good. And unfortunately, United States has done no such thing post-1945, and we will explain this. As you agree with me, Rob, the reason why we began to discuss this theme was an article it was a leading, I mean, Fukuyama predicted the end of the U.S. hegemony in an article that he wrote for the Economist Special 2022 Outlook. And estranged from him, because in 1992, he was one of probably the full of himself, and when he wrote his book, The End of History and the Last Man, literally what he was proposing, that the United States and capitalist system has won the argument, and that's it, the history has come to an end. For him to come and write an article after, 1992 and 2022, about 30 years later, it's clearly an indication that the shift that has taken place in the international system and the challenge that we have to the to United States. And I'm going to read just a synopsis. He states that United States suffered a humiliating defeat when it withdrew from Vietnam in 1975. But it regained its dominance within little more than a decade. Unfortunately, the peak period of American hegemony was recorded between the fall of Berlin Wall in 1989 and the financial crisis of 2007 and 2009. The height of American hubris was the invasion of Iraq in 2003, when it hoped to remake not just Iraq and Afghanistan, which it invaded 2 years before, but the whole of the Middle East. America overestimated the effectiveness of military power to bring about deep political change, even as it underestimated the impact of a free market economic model on global finance. So both of these so-called foundation of hegemonic system is falling apart, the economic on one hand, as well as the military on the other hand. This is something that we really need to discuss as time goes on. So I want to ask, I know we are going to discuss this more. So do you think this prediction, Rob, Fukuyama's prediction, is accurate?
Well, yes, I think it's accurate. What's curious is where it's coming from, as you mentioned. This discussion of the beginning of the end, or the long decline of U.S. hegemony has really been on the agenda. It's since something that he mentioned, and that was the U.S. defeat in Vietnam, specifically in the early 1970s, when other things happened, when the world currency system goes off the dollar, and the beginning of a whole series of challenges where the United States is beginning to lose its grip, if you say, on global power, something that we'll define more accurately again as we go along. So this is nothing new. The whole structure of my teaching was based on what's called world systems theory. Samir Amin, Emmanuel Wallerstein, who have been arguing the same thing, really, the beginning of a decline of U.S. imperialism for nearly half a century. What's new is now we're hearing very conservative voices, defenders of world capitalism, saying the same thing. And these are these are particularly Fukuyama, but there's others who were beating their chests about United States is the only superpower. Without American domination, the world will fall apart, will become chaos. So it's kind of interesting. It's not so much that the notion of decline is new, but where it's coming from. And we mention this, Ibrahim, because without understanding just kind of the trajectory of U.S. decline, which is slow but steady, it continues. Without understanding that, what one of the things we've argued repeatedly is you can't understand what's happening in the Middle East because the United States has been such a dominant player in that region. And that's one of the reasons, dear listeners, that if you listen to our discussions, mostly what we're talking about is geopolitics, the term. And in a sense, what is that really? It's the interaction between the local and the international, and how they mesh or how they conflict, whatever. So this notion, Ibrahim, that you're talking about, of this decline is it's accurate, and it's very, very interesting to hear it. I wanted to mention one other thing about just in response to what you were talking about. You were talking about how successful empires that they have to, at least in their theory, but actually even more than that, most of the time they have to provide the common good for the entire empire, if you like. And, of course, the core, the center, always does better than the outlying areas, the periphery. But if the periphery gets nothing out of the empire, of course, there's going to be rebellion. If we look over time, if we look at particularly in the modern period, one of the things we'll see is that who is it that benefited, if you like, from U.S. hegemony? It was the core of the global economy. So whether we're talking about Western Europe or Japan, it's true that at the end of World War II, these were the areas of the global economy that picked up, were able to recover from warfare. But when we look at the robbery, that's not the case at all. The periphery's had a terrible problem. So listen, Ibrahim, how is it that you...
I want to ask you one question before we go on. Yeah. One of the surprising thing about the article of Fukuyama, we all both understand the hegemonic stability theory, but what he is referring to now, or at least in his resurrection, of this to understanding the reality of the world, he asserts that the polarization within the American society, based on taxes, abortion, various other ideas within the society, they contributed to the demise of the hegemonic power of the United States more than the realities outside. or the fact side. Do you think?
Well, who? You know, I think that this, which is it that contributed more, is a never-ending debate. But let us be clear of what a hegemonic power like the United States claims domestically. It claims it's the best of all possible worlds. Of course, we're talking about the best of all possible worlds in contrast to Soviet communism, all right? That American capitalism could deliver, it could deliver a social contract. In a world where I don't know what the percentages are, but overwhelmingly, this is a world of people of color, of dark-skinned people. The United States had to at least give some indication that it was serious about its struggle against racism. This is also post-World War II or in an anti-colonial period. Now, needless to say, there were some improvements in life here in America, both economically for the working class and the poor, unquestionably, particularly the first 25 years. And also we have, of course, it was a result of tremendous struggles, but the improvement of the situation of people of color, the civil rights movement, the women's movement and the like. Those gains, however, were really quite marginal and conditional. And what we have seen, and of course this everybody knows who's listening to this program, is that it's one thing to have laws to eliminate racism, and it's a whole other ball of wax, as we would say, to eliminate it more deeply in the minds and the hearts of people. And needless to say, we've got a lot of work to do there. So even what we might consider to be, the American mythology of making it and all that, that has eroded, and now we're in a situation, as is well known, at least in my lifetime, Ibrahim, the most polarized political situation I've ever seen. For the United States to be polarized on the one hand and then claim that it's the bastion of democracy and of eliminating poverty on the other, that contradiction is just too strong. And so it can't claim that really anymore. Yes, definitely the domestic crisis here.
And by the way, Rob, everybody who wrote on hegemonic stability theory in the 1970s that claimed the United States deserves or at least well suited to take that hegemonic role, now they are pointing to exactly the point that you raised as the sign of the fracture that has taken place. So this has been coming for a long time, and now we are beginning to see that. But one thing I think at this stage we really need to address, that when we talk about the fall of hegemonic power, it doesn't mean that we, I believe, you agree with me, Rob, that we don't mean a sudden implosion and that's it, the end of it.
It's not an immediate collapse or anything like that.
It's a slow,
right,
long-term process that the country will remain a great power for many years. But just how influential, that is the point that we want to bring to the attention of the listener.
Right.
How influential it will be depends on its ability to fix its internal problem as well as the internal external problem. And the failure is
right
in the external problem. I mean, the polarization that you alluded to shows clearly that internal problem is problematic as well.
Yes.
So you...
There's
a question?
Excuse me? Go on. What?
Did you have a question?
No, it's just how much I agree with you. There is a moment where you begin to see this total dominance, that's really what we're talking about, begin to erode. And it really is the 1970s. And just to go over it briefly, first of all, the shattering impact of the U.S. defeat in Vietnam. We have very little about it. In fact, if you look at the movies and cultural spectrum, you'd think today the United States won the war in Vietnam. Well, it didn't win the war. It was defeated. It was defeated by a nation of peasants who paid a terrible price. And then what the United States was doing in that war in Vietnam is also swept under the rug. It was a horrific war. Today we hear about the And it's tragic, of course, the 58,000 or so Americans that died. We don't hear about the 3 to 4 million Vietnamese who were victimized in this war. So that's one part of it. But there were other things that were happening at the same time. The United States can no longer defend the dollar in the early 1970s. And the dollar, when the dollar was defended by gold here in the United States, that's what gave stability to the global economy. You knew what your exchange rate was and to trade. Once the dollar is so-called released, we have entered a period of financial instability that's only grown since. And then also by the early 1970s, we see a number of competitors. They're actually U.S. allies. But these competitors, they're taking greater and greater market share away from Washington. So whether it's the Germans or the Japanese, the U.S. role in the global economy it's not collapsing, far from it, but it's shrinking. It's shrinking. And therefore, as its role is shrinking, also its influence begins to erode. And that's why we had in the late 70s things like the Trilateral Commission, which is the first attempt, if you like, to manage the new situation. And that's so all, we see these trends again. There's nothing new about them 40, 50 years ago. What has been the position, if you like, of the Republicans of the right wing? It's to deny absolutely firmly that there's a U.S. decline. So we have that. One more point here, Ibrahim, which is really, really, I think, important that we'll talk about. When you look at the United States today, what is its claim to fame? It's military budget, and its bases all over the world. And people mistake the strongest military in the world with hegemony. It's not the same thing at all. The United States, as its economic contribution to the global economy has weakened, it has had to compensate by using, if you like, military bases and intervention and all the stuff that we're well aware of. So, yes, a long, slow decline, which has accelerated at a number of times and which in the past 4 or 5 years has just the acceleration of the U.S. decline has intensified. No question about it.
Hey, Rob, I just wanted to, and Ibrahim mentioning the global dominance, but with the war in Vietnam, it was somewhat global as well. I mean, it involved some allies also sending soldiers to fight in Vietnam, and you know, mostly like Australia, definitely, and some
well,
of the,
Australia,
some,
Turkey. There were a couple of others.
Yeah,
you're right. I mean, although they were very small.
Yeah, yep.
Compared to the 500,000 U.S. troops.
Oh, for sure. But I just wanted to throw that in there. That you know, a large country. Well. A behemoth, in a sense, like the United States, can throw its weight around the world, and the demise the loss in Vietnam was kind of it did affect the globe as well, financial. As you're mentioning, you know,
good point of view. Not only was it a defeat in Vietnam, but the overthrow of the Somoza government in Nicaragua,
right.
The liberation of the former Portuguese colonies in Africa, Guinea-Bissau and Angola and Mozambique. And then probably the most powerful indication of this decline was the U.S. inability to stop the overthrow of the Shah of Iran. And the Iranian monarchy. So think about this: in 1953, it's the United States and the British, you know, that engineer the overthrow of the Mossadegh government. 26 years later, they cannot stop. There's no way that they can stop the emergence of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. So the 1970s politically is a decade of defeat. For the United States, nothing short of that, in the third world, that it's still trying to recover from. Okay,
Right.
By the way, same time, compare. You can compare, even Fukuyama does it. You can compare current Afghanistan crisis with 1970.
Very much so, yes.
And he says, in the same manner that in 1975, United States spent, after spending so much money and suffering so much, at the end had to run away. Look at what happened in 2001, in August 2001, after 20 years of occupation and throwing in so much money and claiming that they've gone in to get rid of Taliban only to make a run for it in the face of the Taliban. That clearly indicates the fracture that exists within this hegemonic system and their inability to do anything about it, particularly that's critical.
And I'm just going to jump in again here and give a little station ID here at the bottom of the hour. The time is coming up on 6:32, and you're tuned to KGNU, and you're listening to Hemispheres, and this is the Middle East Dialogues with Ibrahim Kazrouni, who you just heard, and Rob Prince. I'm your host, Jim Nelson, and we will move on now to discussing more of our topic for this evening.
Ibrahim, I've got a question for you. So I was talking about one of the indicators was some of the events that happened in the 1970s, the indicators of U.S. decline. You mentioned the defeat in Afghanistan. Are there other indicators today that that are suggestive of this, again, relative slow but steady and clear-cut retreat of the United States as a global power?
Yes, I mean, if we have discussed, both of us have discussed this idea. There were days, I remember you were just mentioning it as well. There were days in which you didn't need an American envoy to go to the Middle East or anywhere else around the world for a crisis to be resolved. You needed some undersecretary of state from the Department of State to pick up the phone and make a call to this leader, that leader. Within 24 hours, everything was settled. Now 7 years war in Yemen, United States is not able to impose anything on the Yemenis, and they are standing up to all the bombardment. The crisis in Lebanon, Lebanese are standing up. Recently, we both discussed Nasrallah's speech about the existential fear that exists in Israel vis-a-vis the crisis that has developed, an inability of United States to resolve an issue. In Syria, the same thing. In Iraq is the same thing. Most telling about this would be if, because we are searching for signs within only, say, the region, Middle Eastern region, one could go somewhere else as well. What we have in the cases in Iraq is another example. But most telling sign is the Vienna negotiation of the nuclear issue. The United States is trying to impose on the Iranians something, and Iranians are telling them to get lost, literally. We are not going to follow their command anymore. And this is what Fukuyama is referring to when he says there is a tendency for multipolarity to take shape again in the world. 2 weeks ago, you had confrontation between Iranian Navy and the American Navy about the tanker that the Americans wanted to remove or hijack, whatever, of Iranian oil. What happened? They had to turn back, and Iranian got what they wanted. So all of these signs clearly indicate that the old power, hegemonic power that dictated to the rest of the world and how the world should behave and should practice follow suit and follow the guidelines of the United States is no longer there. This is a clear sign of failure. You want to add anything, Rob?
Yes, I do. This notion, you really hit the nail on the head. It's this notion of dictate, all right? When you're a hegemonic power, you do it informally. Yeah, the president of the United States calls the president of whatever or the king of Saudi Arabia. This is how it's done. Those days are over. And that's one of the reasons why as these crises in the Middle East emerge in different places, the United States has to appoint, quote, a special envoy. And in fact, the special envoy only has created Jeffrey Feldman in the case of Syria. He only created more problems. He did not resolve anything in Syria. Now he's in the Horn of Africa doing the same thing. So the days where the United States can dictate its policies in the rest of the world are over. So that's the first point I wanted to make in response to what you just said. I wanted to briefly talk about Israel, because the dilemma of Israel is really similar in a certain way to the dilemma of the United States. So what is it? Globally, the United States, greatest military power in the world, really nobody comes close, and yet losing its grip in the Middle East. Israel, strongest military power in the region, unquestionably, and yet Israel today, if you read carefully, is in crisis. Israel can no longer dictate in the region what the United States can no longer dictate in the world. They can't go into Lebanon anymore the way they used to. They know they're going to get hit. They're seeing that they can't control the Palestinian movement the way they could. That's the events of recent events that we saw. So it's this really interesting situation where we see the limits of military power. And that military power transformed into, if you like, political power for both the United States and Israel. I'm not sure if the word crisis is appropriate, but their ability to maneuver is being restricted. Do you think that that's a fair estimate, Ibrahim?
Sure.
Or a fair comparison?
Constantly read the newspapers in Israel. The Arabic newspapers, or I listen to the translation of them on other newspapers and the region and so on. When you have the upper echelon of the military industry warning the government, please don't make
in Israel
a move.
Yeah.
In Israel, yes. Don't make a move that would lead us into a war which is not wanted, because the home ground is not ready for the crisis that we have to deal with. We were not developed for the war to be brought into our into our own home. We kind of got used to the idea of taking the war somewhere else. The inability of the Israeli military to take, despite constant maneuvers, trainings, exercise, and so on, they all just show off for the what we call public audience. The Hezbollah, Hamas, and other Palestinians, they know about it. So they don't react to it anymore. There were days as soon as six Israeli tanks got close to the Lebanese border, half of the Lebanese population from the south would run away. Now, Hassan Nasrallah mockingly turned the table exactly in the last speech that he gave, pointed to this point. He said, now, if a Lebanese guy takes one of these machines to drill a ground close to the Palestinian-Israeli or Lebanese-Israeli border, half of the settlement in the north of Israel would run south. That clearly indicates that the situation has changed.
It's dramatically. Now, there's something else here that we really need to discuss before the program ends, because if you look at the end of the Cold War, when the Soviet Union collapsed, needless to say, the collapse of the Soviet Union changed the balance of power, well, everywhere, but in the Middle East, surely. Some of the Arab nationalist governments they really weren't pro-Soviet, but they saw the Soviet Union at least as a kind of a large power that was supportive of their interests. So from that point until really a few years ago, there was this vacuum, and one could talk about, the term has been used, a unipolar world. The United States is the only power. That's not true today, is it? And
no.
The reason it's not true is the emergence of a counterforce. And that counterforce is China, Russia, and Iran, and the growing alliance. Can you talk about how that emerged and what influence that has had, if you like, on the Middle East? They all have slightly different policies and slightly different, frankly, political systems. However, they are becoming, they're becoming very much of a team, it seems to me.
Yeah. I think to understand this, we really need to look briefly at how did this system, hegemonic system that United States imposed on the rest of the world, came to exist after the Second World War. If you look at what is called in the political science language, the aggregate achievement of the both wars, because the United States went on to lead the world hegemony due to enormous economic, financial, political, military strength. By 1945, it had a gross product of 60%, greater than the 15 leading economists on the planet, two-thirds of the industrial capacity, three-quarters of the invested capitals in the world, to which one must add their incomparable scientific, technological, business, and financial abilities. Because of that unique circumstance, the United States imposed this capitalist mindset that requires, by the way, I mean, there are a huge number of scholars that they talk about this, that the hegemonic system by default is unstable.
Right.
It requires huge amount of military, the force to be able to impose it on the rest of the world. And two critical ideas are what we have to be mindful of. Overstretched military and ambitious greater than resources. And unfortunately for the United States, both of these exist. They are the one that would lead to undermining the hegemonic system. So United States comes out of the world, and the both world. The rest of the hegemonic power, the French, the British, and everybody else, have gone through a huge amount of suffering. The United States was able to dominate. You are right that with the fall of the Soviet Union, the vacuum was created. But what happened with Putin and the team that gradually came to power, they understood this relationship, and they worked as hard as possible, gradually to slowly to strengthen their position and fill up the shortcomings and become a major player in the region, at least, or then ultimately in the world. Russia, compared to the fall of the Soviet Union, has got much stronger. Chinese have become extremely stronger within this this period. Iranians, again, have gradually moved out now. They are not worried about the sanction because they have developed their association with the with the Chinese, with the Russian, and with others. So, and the inability of the Europeans to dictate as some kind of extended arm of the United States foreign policy clearly has isolated United States. And really, United States at the moment has no clear vision as how to recuperate that gain, that leadership that had in the past. I mean, Fukuyama says that after 1975, within a decade, the United States was able to get back some of the images. But in the at least post 2007-2008, I would go even a little bit before, in the war of 2006 between Israelis and Lebanese was a turning point. On the one hand, United States, Condoleezza Rice and others were trying to impose the New World Order on the region. On the other hand, what now is defined as the axis of resistance, they were turning back and responding, or at least they were not prepared. I would say that is the turning point, that the United States failed to impose its will, and it was beginning of the somehow watering down of not the Israeli power, not everybody else's power, as well as United States. So this is one of the things that we have to be aware of. China, Russia, Iran, India, and everything else, they are working together based on common interest. They are no longer prepared to operate under the auspices of what we call the hegemonic dictating power.
Just to add a historical dimension to this, there are a couple of thinkers, one is British and the other is American, that have, over the course of really more than 100 years, talked about the key to U.S. global success. And as they put it, that the key is to divide Eurasia. When they're talking about dividing Eurasia, they're really talking about somehow dividing the Soviet Union, or today Russia, from China. And one of the great victories of you know, that that brilliant scoundrel Kissinger was for the famous Nixon trip to China. But where China begins to, the alliance between China and the Soviet Union breaks down. Brzezinski, once again, the national security advisor for Jimmy Carter, and profound lifelong anti-communist, he builds on this theme too, that this is the goal: keep China and Russia separated. And there was some success on that. What is it that the interesting thing from where I'm sitting, what is it that's changed this hostility between China and Russia and turned it into something approaching an alliance today? And a lot of it has to do with U.S. aggressive pressure against both of them. The network of expanding NATO east puts terrible pressure on Russia. Russia looks to China. As the U.S. militarizes the East Asia to a degree that's really quite unprecedented today, China sees what? China sees that the sea lanes are more and more controlled by U.S. military. So how does it respond? The Belt and Road Initiative over the Eurasian heartland. And what's happening now is this integration between China and Russia is not only security-wise. In fact, it's the greatest component is it's economic and social. And as it grows, it's going to be very difficult for the Europeans or countries that are kind of, as is well known, India's kind of move towards Washington. It's going to be very difficult for India to maintain that.
Rob, you just something here. The greatest opportunity for Chinese and the Soviet Union, I mean for the Russians, to be able to succeed by taking a different route through, call it the Silk Road, whatever it is self-inflicted by the for the United States and Europeans. The more United States imposes sanctions on countries in the region, the more they are going to turn towards the Chinese and the Russians for support. One of the
why are we talking about this? Because this Russian-Chinese alliance has also now brought into its midst Iran, and the support that Russia and China give to Iran. The economic relations between China and Iran, $200-300 billion over the next 20 years or so. This is giving Iran confidence that there's a backing there that it did not have before, and it permits it. Well, it doesn't permit it, but it certainly encourages it to stand up to U.S. pressure. Now, think about this. Think of all the countries that the United States has broken using sanctions. And Iran, they were not able to break. And certainly at the heart of that is, if you like, the militancy and the spirit of the Iraqi government and people, the Iranian government and people. But without the support of Russia and China, strategic support, economic support, I think it would have been much more difficult for Iran to survive. This terrible pressure. Is that a fair
here for the Chinese?
Yeah.
And another point here for the Chinese. Chinese now understand the way to domination or indirect hegemony is through what we call public good. right. approach the Lebanese, and they talk about not military. We will build you the railway. We will build you the infrastructure. They approach the Syrians. We will lend you money for reconstruction. We will lend you the team and the management that you need for your electricity, for water treatment, and everything else that that was destroyed by the Americans and the mercenaries, etc. In case of Iraq, the former prime minister of Iraq was deposed indirectly by United States is because his approach to Chinese when United States was not prepared to support the Iraqis. $500 billion deal with the Chinese for rebuilding the infrastructure and everything else in Iraq, removing it from the hand of the Americans. So the Chinese have found a soft touch in every country that everybody would welcome what we call it public good, and the Chinese are prepared to take the disproportionate share of it and support these countries to build their infrastructure while the Americans are constantly threatening sanctions, military takeovers or regime change or everything else. This is and the Russians are doing the same thing, whether it is in Middle East, Chinese are going to Africa. One of the crises that we have in the Horn of Africa is the role of China. And look what happened, Ethiopia and the whole mess in that region.
And I'm glad that you mentioned this, Ibrahim, because the more I study what's going on in the Horn of Africa, I'm convinced that what's happening there is the United States is trying to make an example of Ethiopia because of its ties with China. And if an African country is going to have these ties with China, it's going to pay a price. And that's all that this last year of warfare has been. So the comparison about with the Middle East is there. And this the main point here is that this Chinese-Russian alliance and this Belt and Road Initiative are changing the international landscape. And they are changing the landscape in the Middle East as well. And this is something that not only was Washington and Tel Aviv unprepared for, but they don't know how to deal with it. They certainly don't know how to deal with it in the Middle East. And I'm going to argue that other than defensively, we tried to stop the Chinese in Syria. We tried to stop the Chinese in Ethiopia. So the point here, a new balance of power in the world. This balance of power is changing the regional chemistry in the Middle East or helping that change. Are these things going to happen overnight? No. But there's a whole new reality that is coming into being there. And this alliance has really made a lot of it's hard to say whether it made it possible or it greatly enhanced it. But it's a really, really big factor. And not to understand that, not to understand what China and Russia have been doing in the Middle East and how the region is changing, you're missing the whole point of what's going on, going on in the region from where we were sitting. So with all that, what do we have for time? We only have a few minutes here, huh?
Yeah, I mean, this is.
Do you want to make some
the best
closing remarks, Ibrahim?
You've got about at least another 5 minutes or 4 minutes.
Right.
I would say 4 minutes.
Wow. Well, what can we get in?
Yeah, I mean, what we really can say for the benefit of our audience, this was a very brief attempt to lay the foundation
right.
of the argument that we have. And it's being supported by other leading, even neocons, now they have to admit. That the state of flux that started, say, in the early 1920s, beginning of the 20th century, where the old European powers were eclipsed by the new ones that coming in, the Soviet Union and United States, now we are seeing that state of flux is moving those ones, which is United States in particular, and some of the Europeans, and being replaced by the new ones, the revamped Russia, as well as China, India, Iran is there, Brazil, and some other ones. The desire and constantly. I remember listening, the more I think about it now, I'm listening to the speech President Raisi made to Parliament the moment that he was elected. One thing that he tried to hammer it in, that the age of single polar power dictation hegemonic rule is over. We are not going to accept. We are all going to work for the betterment of everybody else, which is multi-power bases, which is the essence of right. BRICS and everything else. So we are the foundation for the new world order is being laid down, not according to the United States, but according to others that were treated roughly by United States. How, whether United States is going to understand this reality, or whether still hides behind the American exceptionalism, that's something else that has ramification for every single country that we are going to focus on, hopefully next week in the Middle East. If you want to say anything, Rob.
Well, you said you've made the main points. I think the only point I want to add is one of the ways that these changes have been reflected isn't something we hear very little about here in the American media, and if we do, it's in a negative way, and that is a new kind of alliance which is challenging U.S. power in the region, and that's the what's referred to as the axis of resistance. It's actually far more interesting and far more, it's very politically diversified. It doesn't have one particular ideology. So the ideology of the Syrian government is not the ideology of the Iranian government or Hamas or the Yemeni revolutionaries. But they're finding a way to come up with a common program that is implemented in each place in a different manner, but in which they're all supporting one another. And that's something that I think American audiences need to look at more carefully and need to understand that this alliance, this is an anti-imperialist alliance, all right, of a new kind. You know, it's not we're all Marxists or no, none of that. And it continues, quite frankly, to go not from defeat to defeat, but from victory to victory. And we wouldn't know that from watching the American media or reading the New York Times. So, new world situation has it's reflected in the Middle East to a profound degree. I guess this is time. Huh?
Yes, this the music tells us it's the end of another program, but we do have part two coming up next week.
Okay, so stay tuned.
Thank you, Ibrahim. Thank you, Rob. Yes, and thanks. We have run out of this evening's time for this evening's program. And I want to thank Rob Prince and Ibrahim Kazrini for another fine program.